Item four, discussion of the Water Board's role and authority in managing the discharge of salts to groundwater of the Lahontan region.
Good afternoon, Board Chair, Board members, and public. I'm Mike Plaziak, Supervising Geologist and Office Manager, Division Manager for the South Lahontan Basin Division of Victorville. Tonight I'm going to be presenting the Water Board's authority, or role and authority in the discharge of salts to groundwater. And if you recall, part of the reason why we're talking about this, there's two reasons actually. One, dovetails into a comment that was made in our July board meeting when the regulated community, the general manager for the Victor Valley Water Reclamation Authority, had a concern about how we develop a permit and those effluent limits that go into a permit ultimately. And the point he wanted to make, I think, and emphasize, among other points, and I'm not going to go into the other ones, but the one point that he wanted to emphasize is that an incremental change in water quality and improvement that is required in a WDR issued by the board can have a substantial increase in the cost, not only to the discharger, but also to the community. So, and I think the point well taken. The other reason for wanting to bring this up to the board is that staff wrestle with this type of analysis, these types of decisions, and how we come, or I should say, how we make the sausage to bring a WDR for you to adopt at a board meeting. So this ties in really well. I'm hoping that we're going to have more discussions in the future as we get to some real more, or I should say more policy, detailed policy discussions. So, here's our agenda, and I'll talk about the anti-degradation policy, some of the factors that we go in to consider and making a determination on that degradation policy, and also talk about some case studies that we use to kind of emphasize the point. What is the State Board's anti-degradation policy? Or State Board Resolution 6816, also known as the Statement of Policy with respect to maintaining high-quality waters in California, or the anti-degradation policy. And for the purposes of this discussion, I'm just going to call it the policy. Essentially, when this policy establishes a requirement that discharges of wastewater to the state be regulated to achieve the highest water quality consistent for the maximum benefit for people of the state. And I'm going to go into what that means. The policy was adopted in 1968. The Department of the Interior asked for all the states to come up with an anti-degradation policy. California did so. Years later, the EPA came up with its own anti-degradation policy, 1972, I believe. And the difference between the state's policy and EPA's, or the federal policy is really directly related to surface water discharges. Our policy, the 6816, or the policy, applies to surface water discharges and also to groundwater. Not only does the policy apply to considerations that are made in terms of issuing a permit, it also involves considerations that are made to require cleanups. Under 9249, State Board Resolution 9249, which directs how we do cleanups or how we require cleanups to be made by a discharger or a responsible party, also requires a 6816 or policy analysis in there. So the policy, really there's kind of like two parts to the policy. The third I'm going to talk about, that was just simply the Department of Interior saying, hey, when you get this thing done, tell us about it. So I think that's happened since 1968. So I'll focus on the first two parts. The first is the high quality of water. Essentially, it's saying whenever there is existing high quality of water, it must be maintained unless it can be demonstrated that the discharge will produce a change in water quality that comports with these three factors. Maximum benefit to the people of the state. It's not going to unreasonably affect beneficial uses, and also that it's not going to result in water quality that's less than the basin plan or those water quality objectives in the basin plan. The other part of that policy, or the other area, if you will, talks about when the waste discharge requirements, or when the board is issuing waste discharge requirements for discharge to waste into those high-quality waters, the board must ensure that the discharger applies the best practical treatment and controls to prevent a pollution or a nuisance, and that it maintains the highest water quality. Again, the maximum benefit of the people of the state. So those are the two main components of this policy. And every time we issue, or I should say the board issues a permit that does involve a discharge to a surface water or a groundwater, that analysis, and you'll find that in that policy or in that WDR, we will go through that whole process. And this is what we're going to talk about a little bit today, is how we do that analysis and how we make those findings that you're able to push the I believe button when we say that the degradation that's going to occur from this discharge is in the best interest of the people of state and still maintains the highest water quality. So what do we mean by high quality waters? Well, when we're discussing water quality, we do so in context to a water's physical, chemical, and biological characteristics. So any water that has those characteristics that are better than a water quality objective is a high quality water. All right. So an example would be water that we know in some basins as, you know, TDS of 250 to 300, and we know that our secondary standards are 500, 1,000, or 1,500. That water would be a high quality water. You can have a high quality water, and it's constituent specific. You can have a high-quality water with respect to, say, TDS or nitrates. In other words, they're below the water quality objective for a municipal use, yet not be for some other use, or vice versa. Talk a little bit more about that when we talk about some of these other cases. The other term that I think needs to be discussed or talked about in a little more detail, and that is, what do we mean by maximum benefit to the people of the state? That's a hard one to wrestle with, and that involves a number of things that have to be considered. And here I'm showing them. For a request or a port waste discharge that comes to us from a discharger proposing to discharge a waste into the water of the state, we've got to make some analyses. We've got to do some determinations here. And there's four categories that we're going to look at. We're going to look at the beneficial uses of the receiving water, all right, to determine whether or not that receiving water has immune beneficial use, which would have the highest protection standard, and all the other beneficial uses. The environmental factors, what's the background water quality, what are some other discharges that are occurring into the basin, if you will, up gradient, other anticipated uses for that resource, or what's some other beneficial uses, or I should say a similar capacity. And I'm going to talk more in detail what a similar capacity means. Then also, treatment. What are the different treatment options that are available, feasible? And then that fourth one, the economic and social benefits that are associated with the discharge. Not only to the discharger, but also to the community or the people of the state. So as we're doing that analysis, we've gotten that report of waste discharge. It's come in for a discharge. Let's say a wastewater treatment plant plans to upgrade, but increase its flow. So we've gotten that report of waste discharge, and staff's going to go through some quick analyses with the data that they get. Sometimes we'll get a good indication that this discharge is going to be small, you know, locally, we'll have a small footprint, might be temporary. Maybe it's a case where we're going to see an increase in TDS over a period of time that will be ameliorated, you know, after 6 months or a year. Like, for example, I think years ago when we had to do this type of analysis for PG&E, and use of irrigation as a disposal option, and we looked at the fact that salts would be discharged, or at least salts would be flushed through the vasozone into the groundwater, and there would be an increase in nitrates and TDS, but then it would come down over a period of time. But that was a quick assessment. Actually, it turned out to be more complex, as I'll explain here what the complex anti-degradation analysis entails. But we're going to look at those factors. How big is this discharge going to be? What's the expected size of the degradation that's going to occur? Is it temporally limited? And then is this just a minor change in the water quality? Are we talking like 1 or 2%? In those cases, then we can work through that without having to require the discharger to come back to us with any more information. Okay? And sometimes, not all the times, and actually most of the times not, if they've done a good CEQA analysis, we should see what those effects would be if there is a potential for significant impact. And we'll be looking for that. A lot of times, though, if it is going to have a significant impact, we're going to move into the complex or detailed anti-degradation analysis. A lot of times, we're going to go back to the discharger to request those additional elements. And really what those are is getting a better handle on the environmental characteristics, what we know about flow, what's the water quality, those kinds of things. But not only that, you can see when we see that or get an indication that there's a substantial increase in the mass of the pollutant, you know, 50% more, 100% more, then we're going to want to get a detailed anti-degradation analysis. I'll go into what's going to go into that. Also, we can see that potentially there may be some mortality involved in that change in water quality for biological communities, or some changes to growth and reproductive impairment. Those also cause us to request a complex anti-degradation analysis. I wish I could tell you that there's, you know, 4 or 5 steps to getting an anti-degradation analysis done by the discharger. Not the case. We see many of these, and there's no, you know, set pattern or cookbook way of doing these. Some of them will be very detailed, some of them not, and we go through that iterative process with staff. We'll go through that with the discharger. The other thing we're trying to see in these analyses is what's the impact, not only to water quality, but again, the socioeconomic impacts. If we require greater controls on that discharge, what's the effect economically and also socially? So, to those 4 factors that I talked about, the first one, beneficial uses. Obviously, when you look at the basin plan, that's where we're going to go to. We know that there are 22 beneficial uses in the basin plan. Out of the 345 sub-basins and basins in the region, 344 of them have the municipal beneficial use. The one, Searles Valley, does not. Not to say, though, other beneficial uses wouldn't apply, industrial or potentially agricultural. In fact, many of those do. If you look through the basin plan, many of them apply. So we're looking to see what are the beneficial uses that could be impacted. Okay, once we've got an understanding of that, we're also looking at the environmental data that are available to us. In this case, this is a map produced by the Mojave Water Agency. This is their service area here in Red. And the dots, you don't need to see the actual numbers next to dots or whatnot, but the dots just indicate areas that where there are low and high TDS. There's a source for us. There's a repository of information, just like the U.S. Geological Survey. And this is a good case scenario, because I'll tell you, Mojave Water Agency has some great data. And in fact, they're working on that salt nutrient management plan along with Victor Valley Water Reclamation Authority to help us understand our loading to the basin. But what you can do with the data are produce maps like this. And the beauty of a map like this, and it helps staff, is that when you look at these, you know, this color coding of sub-basins within Mojave Water Agency's area, well, you can see that the dark green, those are good areas where there's good water quality, very high water quality, 100 to 300 TDS. In contrast to these areas where it's red, where you can see that we've got TDS as high as 900 to 1100. All right, but that helps us to understand, for that particular proposed discharge or change in a discharge, where it occurs in a basin may help us to understand if we need to be concerned about additional salt loading and perhaps putting greater controls on that discharge so that we don't have a problem and see a basin go from yellow, like this one here, into the red zone. So those are great tools for us. Don't always have those when we're getting a report of waste discharge, but we've got to go back to the discharger to get those data gaps, to fill those data gaps to help us to get a better picture. We'll talk about assimilative capacity. And what is that? Well, that's the ability of the water body to take anthropogenic sources as well as natural, and taking those constituents, I'll say, not sources, but anthropogenic and natural constituents into its water body and still being able to meet those beneficial uses. All right? I have a graphical depiction here to kind of help cement what I'm saying in words and to orient you to what we're looking at here. This y-axis, A to B, is just, say, a concentration of a constituent. Could be anything, TDS, nitrate, whatever, from A to B, increasing as we go up. And so we know that in an aquifer, the background water quality is, say, here. So any discharge that causes a change in water quality above background up to the water quality objective or the beneficial use standard will be a degradation. Anything above that would be a pollution that would need to be remediated. Okay, more than high. So our assimilative capacity then would be whatever in that zone between background water quality and the beneficial use standard. We allow a discharge somewhere in that zone, then what's left is everything from the point where the discharge, the concentration in the aquifer after the discharge, up to the beneficial use standard. And here's an example of that. So if you will turn to enclosure 2, you'll see what I'm talking about here with the relationship to the...
What page is that? Do you know the page?
4-15.
Yes, 4-15. In fact, and I'll be talking off of page 417. 4-17. And you're going to see in there where we did an actual calculation. This is for the Apple Valley subregional plant that Victor Valley Wastewater Reclamation Authority brought or requested a permit from you earlier this year. All right. So how did this work in the analysis? We looked at the fact that, the subregional plant could discharge an effluent of quality of about 8 milligrams per liter, and we're talking about nitrate here in this particular example. And the background water quality is 3.4. So you can see the resulting degradation, represented by the red point right there, after the discharge is predicted to be 6.5 milligrams per liter. So that leaves us with 3.5 milligram per liter of nitrate. That's the assimilative capacity. So that's what's left for any other discharger that comes in and wants to use the beneficial use, or use that assimilative capacity for their discharge. All right. When we went through this analysis with them, we looked at technology. They used a membrane bioreactor to treat the nitrate. We also noted that the degradation was limited to a half mile from the discharge point. And they did a column mixing zone type of analysis where they looked at a mixing zone of about 50 feet deep and out to half a mile. And this is what they concluded, that water quality out to that half a mile radius would be degraded up to 6.5. And certainly when you look at the fact that nitrate increased from 3.4 to 6.5, well, that's a doubling. That's a 100% increase. Why did we allow that? Well, I think the analysis that we did will show that this was in the best interest of the people of the state. It did, as you can see on here, degradation was limited to a localized area, for one. Two, there were no known or foreseeable or uses of that assimilative capacity within that half-mile zone anticipated. And when you look at the fact that treating that water, putting it through not only the membrane bioreactor, but sending it through reverse osmosis would, in fact, double the cost to not just to VBWRA, but also to the ratepayers. They were going to see their rates go up from $11 to $22. Right? Those are the kinds of analyses that went into the recommendation to allow that degradation at that level. That's how we looked at that for the Apple Valley sub-regional plant. The other thing, too, I'll mention is this is for a plant that was going to take treated water that's going to be used for recycled water purposes. So when they're not using the recycled water, they don't have any users, in other words, for the recycled water, they had to have a place to store it. But ultimately, over time, there'll be more users of the water, so there'll be less impact into the water quality. This really represents a worst-case scenario. If you look at enclosure 1, and that, I'm moving backwards, I apologize for going from 3 to 2 to 1, but enclosure 1, big stamp 4-7, at the Hesperia plant, this again, a sub-regional plant, is a WDR that we brought before you back in the early part of this year for a similar discharge like in Apple Valley, except to Hesperia. The point I want to make here was our TDS discussion. Here, the effluent water quality is 370. Background is about 275. All right, and so the resulting water quality was going to be 354. Now, point I want to make is that TDS has a three-part standard. It's a secondary MCL or secondary standard because TDS is not a primary pollutant. Primary pollutant being one that will cause health effects. This is a secondary one that has a taste and odor concern. All right, if you get above 1,000 milligrams per liter, the water becomes malodorous. It's not very palatable, and it's not good for it to be consumed or be sold. So that's the basis of the three-part standard. The point here is, and the challenge for staff, is with a three-point standard, if you were to go and look at our WDRs over time, we've never put in a numerical number, thou shalt meet this effluent limit for TDS. We've said for the receiving water shall not exceed the water quality objectives. All right, well, which one of these three is it? 500, 1,000, or 1,500? What we've done, what staff have done over the years, this has been something that's just the way we've done business, and this is what I wanted to get in front of the board so you get an understanding of how we look at or view the world from our regulatory standpoint. When we get a report of waste discharge asking to degrade water quality, if the receiving water's background water quality is less than 500, we generally apply that 500 as a standard to which we're going to require controls be applied to the discharge so the discharger has to meet that and their effluent quality will be such that it will not exceed, the receiving water will not exceed 500. Okay? And in this case, with the same kind of conditions existed in Hesperia as they did for Apple Valley as far as the type of treatment. It was MBR treatment. They did not use reverse osmosis. They could have. They could have brought that down even more than 354, down to below 300 if they used reverse osmosis. But again, the rates would have doubled in that case. It was still protective of water quality, and there still is a similar capacity between 354 and 500. So this is 146 milligrams per liter of TDS here. All right, so that's how we came to that conclusion with that particular case. And you can see more of the details there in the enclosure. But the point I want to bring up is that's how we maintain high quality water in places where the TDS is less than 500 generally. That's our rationale. In areas where the TDS is less than 1,000, well, this model kind of represents that. If we have TDS that's, say, 600 milligram per liter and it's background water quality, we're going to require that discharge. The effluent limits that we'll impose on that will ensure that the receiving water will never exceed 1,000. Okay, so that's how we'll apply it in that case. Likewise, if the receiving water is actually above 1,000, then we're going to use 1,500 as that level. Okay, so this is the rationale that we take when we're looking at the environmental factors, beneficial uses, and then the treatment and controls. And on that subject of treatment and controls, what do we mean by best practical treatment or control? And generally, that's the level of treatment or control that is achievable using best efforts. What are best efforts? Well, that's the quality of the supply water available to a discharger. The historic effluent quality that the discharger has been able to achieve in the past. Like with the case of BBWA, when we went through that process of a permit that Logan was bringing up to you, that we had looked at their ability to achieve, I think it was less than 6 milligram per liter for nitrate. So we wanted to keep to that, all right? And that was going to cause a significant problem to them when they increased their flows, all right? So, but we were looking at the historic effluent quality. We also want to look at other dischargers under similar conditions. What are the technologies that they're using, and what are the levels that they're achieving in their effluent? And any other good faith efforts that the discharger has taken to try to get their effluents or their effluent limits, their effluent quality down to a lower level, to a better quality. So those are some things that go into this, and any other measures that might be necessary. Certainly, technology and performance and cost are those things that they're going to bring up. When we look at the fourth factor, socioeconomic issues, this is one of the most challenging for staff to go through. We're geologists, we're engineers, we're environmental scientists, we are not economists. So the challenge is to go through and read the report of waste discharge or an anti-degradation analysis that comes with that report of waste discharge or subsequently, and understand what do they mean when they say 200 and some odd jobs are lost in the community. How do we verify that? How do we know? What's the metric that they're using to make that assessment? And what are their assumptions? So those are some significant challenges on there. But it's not only what's the cost to the discharger. And the cost to the discharger cannot be the sole reason on a socioeconomic factor for allowing the discharge to have a poor water quality. There's got to be a direct correlation or direct demonstration by the discharger that it's also an impact to the community. That's got to be in there. So you can see in this case here, if the discharge, you know, due to the type of industry we're talking about, whether it's, you know, a bottled, you know, plant discharging salts, or it's some other, you know, it's a wastewater treatment plant, if there's an increase in employment from that, that's got to be factored in there. Or increase in production because now they've got the capacity to do that with a lower cost to run their overhead. And also, does the increase in treatment capacity for a wastewater treatment plant now allow for greater development, more houses to come into a neighborhood, that kind of thing? All right. So I want to kind of close on this with some of these challenges. And I talked about the economic and social development challenges where the analyses are a challenge for us to come before you and ask for you to adopt a permit. A recommendation that I would make, and I hope that it can be taken to the state board as well, is that we know that there are resources at state board that can do economic evaluations. The problem is there are not very many. I think there's one individual up there that does those to support enforcement actions. But I really do think that, you know, when we start to see more and more of these type of analyses come through, and we're requesting these, I can tell you back in the day we didn't do that as much. We're doing that just to have a better understanding of what's the loading going on to the basin. So we're going to need some assessment, or I should say we're going to need some support for those economic assessments. that we can, because it takes the burden off of staff, which don't have the skill sets. We don't have those skill sets. We've got to put those in the right area. The other thing is, I would say, is another challenge is the sub-basin-wide understanding of baseline water quality. Now, what Mojave Water Agency is doing is greatly helping us out. They have a huge network. They work in partnership with the U.S. Geological Survey. But there are other basins that don't have that luxury. Now, I'll tell you, though, that I know at least in the southern part of the region, and I believe it's the same case in the north, the work that staff is doing, integrating in with the IRWIMPs and helping them and giving them guidance and how to understand our perspective, is gaining traction for us to help them at least understand how we look at TDS, how we look at some of these various constituents as they're developing their models and they're developing appreciation for salt loading in the basins. I think it's a good thing, and we're going to have to continue to do that. But data is what we need in order to make those decisions. It's very difficult for staff to tell a discharger to, you know, incur another $2 or $3 million in treatment costs when you don't have data to back up why that's important. And do we see an actual problem with salt loading in that particular segment of the basin? So data are very important to us. I talked about the application of the three-part taste and odor water quality objective, and you can see there's some ambiguity. There are going to be cases where the water quality is below, say, 500. And the discharger wants to go over that 500 mark. And they're asking us to give them that ability to degrade the water and use up the similar capacity and now use the 1,000 milligram per liter level as the new benchmark. You know, and that's a stand that we've tried not to allow that type of situation to happen, because we realize that we are in closed basins. We have salt that's going to continue to load. How do we address that? What's the way we're going to have the information to make those decisions with the discharger to get to a much better control on that discharge? All right, that's a challenge for us, particularly that three-part objective. And lastly, and very importantly, the long-term cumulative effects. We produce, or I should say, we work through permits for the discharger for a particular case, but what we need really is to be able to look at the long term and see how these are cumulatively coming together. And I think one of the tools that we're going to continue to work with on are the IRWIMPs and those efforts, because there are agencies like the Mojave Water Agency in particular in the Mojave Watershed. We're seeing them develop a gross approximation for each basin using a STELA model. I think that's good, because we can take those gross approximations and then have an understanding of which basins are really more vulnerable to loading, and use that as a way or trigger, if you will, to require greater controls on the discharge. And while other ones we might not, but those efforts that are going on with the salt nutrient management planning from the IRWIMPs is very important to that effort. And, you know, policies like the State Board's recycled water policy, I think, are also helping us out in that regard as well. So that's it, I would say, as far as how we make the sausage before we bring it to you. And I hope that you got an appreciation, though, for some of the challenges that we've got, and particularly when we're dealing with TDS, and that staff is trying to keep those discharges to maintain high water quality below 500. And we do that not only for a new discharge, but also when we're evaluating or developing cleanup strategies as well. I'll entertain any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sandell, any questions or comments?
Yes, I do. I first of all, I appreciate the great difficulty in dealing with these issues. This is tough stuff, because it has direct implication on cost to a customer of water treatment, what your monthly bills look like. It's hard. I think that I completely disagree with the idea that we take this 1,000 and 1,500 as the. It's one thing to say a 500 where we have a high quality water. Once you get past 500, it's not good quality water. To get to 1,500, it's really not good quality water. So to allow it to go a step of 500 to be the next, to be considered that whole range as part of the assimilative capacity, seems to be an error in judgment, that we should always be trying to push that number down. And the higher the background is, the more resistant we should be to allowing it to increase at all, is the way I would look at that. Secondly, I think that when we're looking at rate changes to the local rate payers, that we should be looking at something more than just the percent of increase to them. We should be looking at what comparable districts all over the state are paying. We know that in some cases rates are artificially low, that other people are paying 4, 5, 10 times more than what these people are paying. And so to say that it went from $10 to $22, well, that's really, you know, that's not good. But maybe somebody else is paying $60, you know, for a comparable system. So we should be making our comparisons more wide-ranging, I think. And then lastly, and this is not necessarily under our control, but it's something that I think that we could promulgate and work with Mojave Water Agency and others, and that is, we're only looking at one side here. We should be looking at the quality of drinking water. We could improve the quality of drinking water by RO, for example, and the resulting change in the output to the treatment plants would be less TDS. That's another way to deal with this issue. Instead of treating the sewage, treat the drinking water. It might be more cost effective. We ought to think about that as part of the overall equation.
I appreciate those comments, because that helps us have a better understanding of where we draw the lanes in the road.
Anything else, Mr. Stanton?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Dyens?
Yes, thank you. I agree with Mr. Sandell. We should be very reluctant to raise allowable limits of TDS in groundwater from 500 to 1,000. I'd like to keep the water as low in TDS as possible. I have a question about slide 14. By the way, these are great graphics in helping us understand kind of a complex subject. And what I'd like to know is, for this particular example, what safeguards do we have that would prevent an individual discharger from consuming all of the remaining assimilative capacity for a basin?
All right. Well, for a basin, let's put this in perspective, because I think that, you know, when we talk about basins, talking large areas, in this case, in this analysis, we found that the assimilative capacity was going to be 3.5 milligram per liter per nitrate within a half a mile of the discharge. So that's a localized discharge and a localized degradation in the basin, which is, you know, quite expansive. When we look at it, this is the essentially, this is your the sweet zone, the sweet spot, as people will refer to in our watershed, where it's the watershed where the water's coming from the headwaters of Lake Arrowhead down into Hesperia. Very, very good quality water. So this discharge here is only going to affect a very small part of that whole basin. But to answer your question about how do we ensure that is in fact what's going to happen, well, that's where the monitoring requirements that we put into that WDR will ensure that we'll be able to see that they are in fact complying with that.
What I'm really concerned about is allowing what's remaining of the assimilative capacity to be taken up by one discharger. In other words, when we have multiple dischargers in a region, a basin, sub-basin, to be equitable, should we consider developing a TMDL for salts?
Yeah, probably. You know, we need to be looking at site-specific water quality objectives, I think.
We've got... the salt nutrient management plants in part are addressing some of those issues, because you're looking at not only an individual discharger and not only discharges of waste, but also activities on the land, too. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to account for all of those things. So it is kind of like a TMDL for salts.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Horn?
I was afraid you were going to say that. I have random disjointed thoughts. I'm just going to say them as they come to me. First of all, I want to say I completely agree with Mr. Sandell's comment about once the groundwater basin is above 500 TDS, that it's, I think, wrong thinking to allow the groundwater basin to go up to the next level. I think that trying to keep those levels as low as possible is a better policy. On slide number 8, could we go there? And before I go on with my comments, I also want to say I agree with Mr. Sandell's comment about looking at what other districts are doing in terms of what their comparable rates are. I'm intrigued by his comment about improving drinking water. That's an interesting idea. And I was also had the same question that Mr. Dias had about when there's multiple dischargers in the same basin. But as to this slide, I'm curious, when you do this analysis, how are you talking to what people are doing in other regions, or is there guidance from the state board? I mean, or do you make it up as you go? I mean,
oh, she's on to me now. Yeah, well, all right. As far as the anti-degradation analyses go?
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, in terms of, you know, how you think through this, is this the Victorville office's approach, or are you also looking at what they're doing in Santa Ana, or...
Well, we were on the back stoop with some cigars thinking about it. And actually, what we did in a serious way, and the guidance is out there. And just to let you know, the State Board actually has formed a working group to look into 6816 and to see if there are some changes that can be made or revisions or some clarification can be provided to the regulated community. So that's ongoing, and I think they've already had a couple of listening sessions, and I think there's another one in a couple of weeks. That is great, because the guidance that we do have, we have the Atwater memo. It was an Office of the Chief Counsel that came out in 1987.
Right.
That's one. And then after that, we have the Administrative Procedures Update, APU 90-004. That was another thing that provided us with a little bit more guidance on when is an anti-degradation analysis, you know, really required and what should go in it. And then in February of 95, the State Board put out a question and answer memo to kind of explain 6816. So those are the three documents that we rely on within the state. And the federal government also has it in 40 CFR, I think it's section 131. So those are references for us to go to. And the fact that I can tell you those numbers, I would tell you staff, I know, has referred to those and will continue to do that to understand what needs to happen. But we do need some clarity in some of the things that were, you know, with 6816, just like some of the definitions I went through before, what is a best interest of the people of the state, that maximum benefit of the people of the state, that does need a little bit of clarification, even more specificity to help us with those kinds of analyses. Because we can do, in the simple anti-degradation analysis, we can do that all day long. We can look at the environmental factors. We can look at the beneficial uses. I mean, you start going to the complex or detailed analysis, that's when you're looking at not only the treatment, the best practical treatment and control, but you're looking at those socioeconomic factors. That's the challenge for us.
And another quick question about this slide. Does the analysis, does your analysis change depending on whether the water basin is adjudicated or not? How does that affect your analysis?
Not really. I mean, the anti-degradation analysis is constituent-specific. We're looking at each of those constituents, and we're looking at the basin or basin plan's beneficial uses, and we're looking at those in context of each other to see what's the threat to beneficial uses. So whether it's adjudicated or not, I mean, I think it will have an impact tangentially, but not in the direct analysis on a discharge.
Okay. Next slide would be number 13. Okay, my brain works in terms of time, I'm afraid. So, what time frame are we talking about? Are we talking 20 years, 100 years in terms of... Or maybe we should go to the next slide after that. Maybe my question will be clearer with 14.
Well, in this case, and Jay Cass, you can correct me if I'm wrong. There you are. That is the predicted water quality after the discharge in that aquifer. So
over what time period?
Well, I can't tell you if it's months or years or, but I think it's not decades. We're expecting, once the water starts to go into the aquifer, that we're going to see this type of degradation. Now, will it get out to the half mile in a month, a week, a year? I can't tell you that. But the time scale is not decadal. It's probably on the order of years based on the aquifer characteristics. Some aquifers have good transmissivity, so it might happen quicker. Other aquifers, not so much. Is that...
Mr. Cass is sitting behind you.
He's behind me.
Well, Mike, if I could add to that, in doing this analysis, we're looking at the discharge. So as long as there is a discharge, that would be the degree of degradation. If the discharge, I guess two things. When would we go from ground zero baseline up to that level of degradation? We don't factor that very well because using the models we have, they're a mixing model that assumes a more uniform discharge than will really occur. And secondly, if the discharge
uniform
would stop...
Uniform in time or uniform in space?
Typically, a mixing model is set up to be more of an instantaneous mixing model, and that's just a computer model where it looks at what's coming in naturally, what might be coming in from the discharge, and what would the net effect be. So there's not really a... temporal element in that consideration. And then, of course, if the discharge were to stop, how long would the degradation remain? We don't have a good handle on that because for our wastewater plants, typically we assume that we're going to be continuing that discharge for a long time.
I guess I'm confused because, I mean, all right, these are for, these two enclosures were for treatment plants, right?
Yes. Well, they're for sub-regional plants.
Plants, which are operating over some period of time.
They are going to operate over a period of time. I can't really tell you, though, if it's going to be, like I said, 1 or 2 years. If you'd like the details, we could probably get back with you on it. But I think your comment, though, was kind of in general.
No, right. She's talking about the sub-regional plant. I think I can help just because I can see Amy's brain taxing over this. And because in general, you're right about wastewater. That's what Jay's talking about. You know, every day people flush, the flows don't change that much. Well, these two examples that Mike has shared with the sub-regionals, the plants are there. They're going to treat a set volume of water every day, you know, 1 million gallons per day. That's what they're designed to treat. That's what they're going to treat. 1 million gallons are going to come into that plant. 1 million gallons are going to leave. But when it leaves the plant, it's supposed to go in a purple pipe and be used for water recycling. Okay.
Except it's not.
Well, except that it doesn't. The plants don't exist yet, and no one is using the water. Right. But the day those plants begin operating, the hope is there are people who will be using that water. They're not. So the point. This is a different scenario. Okay. So when we talk about the modeling and the temporal nature, is that on a day-to-day basis, the plant's going to produce 1 million gallons per day. On a day-to-day basis, different amounts are going to get used on plants, and the remainder is going to get percolated in these ponds. So the modeling that was done assumed that the whole 1 million gallons per day would percolate into the groundwater every day for the next 35 years, okay? So
oh, that's 35 years.
Okay, so let's just say. But the point being that the modeling just looks at it like it's operating every day that way. Every single day, 365 days a year. But the reality, we hope, is going to be that there's only going to be a few months out of the year where stuff is percolating, or maybe portions of that 1 million gallons. So that's why... That's why you're getting, you know, that's why you're a little confused in terms of what's going on, because it's confusing and none of us know what's really going to happen. This is the worst case. We permitted it knowing that if they had no users of this water could be percolated and would have this kind of impact at that location on an ongoing basis. So that's
okay. I mean, 35 years, I think, was the answer I was looking for. You did make it up?
It's not based on a period of time.
I don't understand. It's a facility that's built to run for a certain period of time.
Well, it's got, right, and most plants are built for that type of lifespan, and they may continue to run for 50 to 100 years with some additional engineering improvements along the way. Well, so that's just a typical engineering assumption, 35 years, okay?
The point being
that the modeling is that the groundwater continues to be replenished. So that analysis of degradation going for about a half a mile away from the plant is based on the fact that there's water there. It's just like a river. It's different than a river, but just like at a surface water where you're going to have an ongoing discharge, there's an assumption that there's going to continue to be fresh water mixing with that. And so, in other words, the pollution at the site or the degradation should not get worse over time because of dilution within the aquifer, within the groundwater basin. So even though, yes, there is an ongoing load of salt, it's not really going to be measurable. Maybe over hundreds of years you would see a long-term, maybe expansion of the degradation. But that, the modeling looks at things over a pretty short time frame, not a geologic.
Second law of thermodynamics, I think.
This is why, though, it is important, though, on the opposite end of this, is that we do have good monitoring, not just what you're going to see at the plant itself, but that network that I was talking about that other agencies are working through, that we're looking at the basin in general, just like the STELA model is looking at with Mojave Water Agencies and different sub-basins, to see whether or not some of those colors are starting to change. You know, and they're taking into account the large inputs into those basins. In fact, I think these plants are incorporated into those model calculations.
Okay, I think we've covered some of my other concerns. Again, the issue about when the TDS is above 500. I think we have to think bigger than impacts on human health. We have to think in terms of opportunity cost, in terms of other economic activities that might go on in these areas as if the good high water quality is maintained. And I know that that sounds very hypothetical, but I mean, maybe there's some crops that could be grown if it stays below 500 but could not if it goes above. Maybe there's high-tech engineering plants that can be built here if it stays below 500, but not if it goes above. I mean, there are other economic factors and opportunities. Humans are, I'll get on my soapbox now. Humans are very inventive people, species, and as long as there is a resource here that can be used, people will figure out a way to use it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is when the resource becomes unusable, as in Easter Island in the book Collapse, if anybody read it. So, that's, I think, my concern is, maintaining the water quality at a level that keeps options open in the future for different types of economic activities than what we are seeing here at this minute. I'm sure in economics we always talk about buggy whip manufacturers. They're what we always hold up. And I'm sure the buggy whip manufacturers were pretty upset when buggy whips were going out of business. But, you know, they moved on. They found something else to do, hopefully. What else do I have to say? When it comes to... I'm looking now at slide number 20. With these public interest factors, and I appreciate the difficulty in looking at these kinds of issues. I thought it was very useful the way when we were looking at the TMDL for Tahoe, that the scientists, the UC Davis scientists, coded everything in terms of the degree of confidence they had about the number. So there were some numbers, and a lot of the numbers you're dealing with are numbers that come out of models, and so the same was true for them. But they color-coded them depending on whether they were really confident or not about the numbers that they had. And I think it might be helpful to go through that kind of exercise with when you're looking at this kind of anti-degradation. I mean, you are going to find that you have the greatest confidence around the numbers that you derive in your area of specialization, right? I've worked a lot with the economic kinds of numbers, and I don't particularly have a lot of confidence in those numbers because, as I just said, people are very creative and innovative and come up with new technologies, new products, new processes that we don't even know about right now and that make the future different than what we see. So a lot of these economic analysis tools are very static, and I'm not sure that it's... I appreciate you're wanting to have more help on that area. I'm not sure the information you would get would be more reliable without... I mean, I'm not sure it's worth the effort, really, to put a lot of money into that. And really, it might be better to really work hard on the areas where you have expertise and then, find some other ways to... Are you required to do an economic analysis? Is that...
In a complex analysis, yes.
You are.
I would also just point out, in waste discharge requirements, we're required to consider economic considerations.
Yeah, but...
So it doesn't necessarily mean analysis, but it's a general requirement. But we have to have some way of considering those issues, especially if we're getting evidence from the discharger that's giving us numbers and giving us impacts related to what we're requiring. We have at least a way to truth it.
Right. Well, I mean, so one interesting exercise that maybe some master student would like to do is to do a retroactive study when people have come in and said, this is going to have this kind of economic impact, and to see whether it really did. I mean, now you begin to see the problem with economic analyses, right? I mean, it's... this requires more thought, obviously, but I just hesitate to encourage you to put a lot of energy in down that route without thinking more carefully about exactly what we would get for that. Okay.
I think I can actually answer a question you had earlier. I just want to use a dairy analogy for this. This is not a discharge permit that we're issuing. This is about where do we go with cleanup and what we're requiring through enforcement actions, which we're doing with the dairies. But in the case of some of the dairies where we've got water quality that's up in the 2000s, 3000s, right? What we're currently working on through our dairy strategy is source control. And by that, I mean we're working through applying the wastewater, wash water to the crops at agronomic rates. That's a disposal technique. That's what they're using. In cases, though, where they don't have enough arable land, they've got to use surface impoundments or something that will prevent that water from percolating. That's a strategy that we're approaching right now. So that a eventually, over time, as we apply source control, we should see the concentrations drop, not just below 1,500, but the goal would be to be below 1,000. Ultimately, we'd like to see it even lower than that. But we've got to, you know, we've got to look at the practicality of where can we get that number. And that number hasn't been developed yet. We're just working on source control. But I can tell you that we are working through this, and we are cognizant of the fact that we don't want to just derive a solution that gets us right at the line at 1,500 or at any other MCL. We've got to go, obviously, in context to 6816, what's the best interest of the people of the state, and how do we maintain the highest water quality. But that is an example of what we're doing in terms of the dairies.
Mr. Jardine, questions or comments?
Just a few brief comments. I do agree with Mr. Sandell regarding anything above 500 TDS. And also I share with Mr. Dias the multiple discharges, though we may have many in a basin. And I'll keep it short and simple. Thank you.
Ms. Cox?
Thank you. Well, I think all the comments prior to mine help amplify what an exceptionally complex discussion this is, and truly can't be solved in a short dialogue. I think it's important to note when assimilative capacity is discussed that it's in a localized context and on a case-by-case basis. That assimilative capacity is going to vary from project to project, particularly depending upon the geology and the hydrogeology of the area. It's good to note on that one slide, number 14, that is indeed a worst-case scenario. I was wondering that when you showed it, how that was determined to be the case. It's good to know that in all probability the end result will be significantly better than that. I do know that using my body of expertise, which is this watershed area, and it's an adjudicated basin, that most of the municipalities have been very aggressive in putting in purple pipe so that when these subregionals do get built, they will truly go to beneficial use. I think it's also important to note that, you know, we're dealing with the MCLs, the maximum contaminant level for nitrates, as well as the secondary maximum contaminant level, which only deals with aesthetics, you know, smell, odor, visible occlusions in the water, whereas the MCLs deal with health risk. And these, of course, are established by EPA and Cal-EPA. So there is already standards in place that all of the water purveyors must deal with, and there's, I think, a broad understanding of the effects of these different constituents. So I think there's a great deal of buy-in by the stakeholders to embrace the objectives that are looking to be achieved. And I think truly the beneficial uses will vary, just as the assimilative capacity will, by region. In our region down here, we get 5 inches of rainfall per year. So any amount of water, even if it is slightly degraded, even if it has TDS, is appreciated and better than no water at all. There have been arid regions in our area, thinking of the eastern desert, that have actually undergone moratoriums because of the lack of water resources. So there is truly an understanding in the southern Lahontan region of the value of water. There is also, I believe, an acceptance of slightly degraded groundwater quality or even discharge from wastewater facilities with the understanding that the beautiful aquifers that we have here will purify the water. And as they are pumped out to be delivered by the purveyors then will adhere to the water quality requirements that have been issued by EPA and Cal-EPA as far as the MCLs and the SMCLs. So I know in our region it is truly a water cycle. It is used, it is recharged, it is purified by the aquifer, and it is used again. So I think understanding the vast differences in the region within Lahontan, that I think more work is definitely needed. I think stakeholder input, because when you look at the extreme diversity in this region, there are truly different needs, different desires, willingness to accept some water quality changes in some areas versus the desire to embrace only pristine and non-degraded water supplies. I just think a further dialogue for all of us is certainly a good thing for us to look at in the future, because it all has economic impacts, however you look at it. Thank you.
I just had a couple quick things. I kind of share Mr. Diaz's concern about the wiggle room and the assimilative capacity, and I sort of I'm kind of reassured by the fact that, or the notion that these are localized or could be considered in many cases to be somewhat localized impacts. But on the other hand, when I see the phrase known or I'm concerned about, the sense in which you think that all of the impacts to assimilative capacity are actually known. Because if you think that the pond is this big, but there are impacts to that volume that are not known, then you may be pushing the available capacity closer than people might realize. So I would hope that at least as we look at these on a case-to-case basis, that some consideration is given as to the certainty that you have that all of the known impacts or all of the impacts are known, and there might not be something lurking out there. The other question I had was, the comment was made that, you know, the groundwater is going to continue to be replenished. That may or may not be true to the same extent as has been the case historically. And so I would imagine that your analysis would have to take into consideration what kind of changes in the availability of replenishment may accompany climate change or different hydrology cycles or things of that nature. Lastly, I understand Dr. Horn's concern about the economic analysis and the ability of people to do it. The problem that I have is that the economic analysis is usually the analysis that the proposed discharger falls back on to say, you know, yeah, we're going to have consequences here, but they certainly should be allowable because the world is going to end unless we're allowed to go forward in the worst-case scenario. So we are obligated to deal with that. And in order to protect the analysis of the other factors, we have to be able to make a robust analysis of those arguments, if only to make a solid record for our own decisions. So I appreciate the fact that obviously resources may be needed to help do that. And so my last question was going to be, other than looking straight at the state board member and saying resources are going to be needed to help us to accomplish that. Is there anything else that the board can do or that you would recommend that the board consider doing in order to make this task more manageable or to help you secure the resources that are needed to do it?
You just started. You just, all of you just gave staff some guidance, whether it was, you know, direct, but you gave us a perspective on how you see things. I hope this isn't the last time we have this dialogue. I think this has been helpful for staff. So that helps us to understand where you kind of see the lines being drawn so that we can better inform the dischargers what's going to work and what's not going to work, what's going to be acceptable, in other words, to the board and your proposed discharge and what's not. Those things are priceless for staff to have that kind of perspective so that we can navigate much more efficiently and faster and more accurately with a discharger. As far as the economic piece, I don't know what the board can do in that realm. I mean, other than lobby for us at other places higher up to say, you know, that's a gap that we have. It's a skill set that needs to be there. It's not in our current, you know, table of organization, at least not at the regional boards. So we should look at some ways that we can solve that data gap or that skill set gap.
Thank you very much. This has really been fascinating.
Thank you.
It's been really informative to us, and I appreciate the effort that went into it. Thank you. Yes, please do.
I just wanted to say, again, same as Mike so eloquently said, our thanks to the board for giving our staff this guidance. This really is very valuable to us as we move forward, as these permits come before us. And again, as Mike said, we'll be back for more of this. It also helped inform us as we participate in the statewide discussions on anti-degradation policy to better understand what is important to the regional board and their thoughts and guidance as we move forward on that. And lastly, on the economic analysis, it is a struggle. I know all state agencies, particularly environmental agencies, are struggling with this issue because more and more we're being asked to do this when we consider regulatory actions. The Air Board probably the most has been asked this question because there's no perfect economic model. They're very difficult, and they do not consider the avoided costs or the benefits to the public health from having clean drinking water, less visits to the hospital, other things like this that are not quantified in economic analyses, but equally as important for us. So it is something we're struggling with, and I again thank the board for this guidance for us as we move forward to help see if we can effectuate some of these changes.
Thank you. That's our last agenda item for this portion of the meeting.